Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is Friday, August 1st, 2003. Today's session is entitled, Where is the Compassion? Session 4 of Proclaiming the Year of the Lord's Favor in Our Global Reality. Some New Visions for the Future of God's Earth and God's People. Presented by Jim Bowman. Number BOJ2003-04. Let's listen in. I've
seen some of you earlier in the week, and it's always nice to see new faces. I work with the with Lutheran World Relief, which I'm sure that all of you have heard about, and part of Lutheran World Relief that I work with is their office in Washington, their Office of Public Policy. I'm director of that office working on policy issues as it affects primarily developing countries around the world, especially those countries where we have programs. I'm going to begin with a prayer for the Millennium Development Goals that we'll be talking about later on, not right at the beginning, but it's a prayer that's been developed in relationship to that, and I think it's appropriate to use that to begin. The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
In a world where so many go hungry, let us make the fruits of creation available for all. In a world where 1 billion of our brothers and sisters do not have safe drinking water, let us help the waters run clear. In a world where so many children die so young, and so many mothers die in childbirth, and so many families are ravaged by disease, let us bring health and healing. In a world where women carry such heavy burdens, let us recognize and restore the rights of all. Let us join together with a new sense of global community, a new awareness of our need for one another and for this fragile planet, to meet the clear challenges of the Millennium Goals, to bring hope as substantial as bread, to make human dignity as visible as wheat in the fields. In the name of Christ our Lord.
Amen.
I had hoped to have enough of these books. We're going to just use this as a reference. So when and we're not going to use it all the time, very much, but when I do mention it, you may want to just peek over someone's shoulder who has it, so, or get next to those of you who have it, raise it up, and then those of you who don't can kind of sneak in close. You don't have to do that now. That may be, may not want to be that close all the time, but just peer over their shoulder when I refer to a particular page in this document. I'm going to talk a little bit about foreign aid in as it relates to our own history, U.S. history, U.S., and we won't go back too far, but we'll try to stay within the lifetime of most of us who are here in the room, and then talk a little bit about where it's been effective, where it's not been effective, some of the new goals that have been set that our country has signed on to, the Millennium Development Goals that you may or may not have heard about, and how we are doing in reaching those goals. I think when we talk about the impact of globalization and some of the issues that we're facing in terms of the economy around the world, we tend to look on the negative side and see only what's not working, and we see only hungry people, and we don't see some of the encouraging progress that has been made. And I think it's important to talk about that because we are a people of hope, and I think we need to give expression to that whenever we can. I'm going to begin with a Chinese proverb that goes like this. A person who has food has many problems. A person who has no food has only one problem. When you think of foreign aid now, say in your own lifetime, and sort of the big foreign aid programs in the past. Let's talk about, at least at the beginning, some of the success stories. What is the big, if you were to list the maybe the first thing that jumps into your mind is sort of the major foreign aid program that we were involved with.
What
the
Marshall Plan.
The Marshall Plan. Good. Marshall Plan coming at the end of World War II and primarily directed towards Western European countries, Japan, and also Turkey, and I think Greece was a part of that. Rebuilding those countries, and a fairly successful plan at that. In fact, so successful as far as Japan is concerned, that Japan is now considered one of the wealthy countries and is one of the countries that far surpasses many other countries in terms of its own foreign aid programs, and we'll come to that later on. Another, I don't know if we can think of it perhaps as a foreign aid program as such, but it was in the 60s and 70s there was something else going on in terms of foreign aid, I guess you could call it that. What was happening at that time? It was in the area of agriculture. I'll give you that clue. What was the word given to that agricultural development that was going on?
Was it the Green Revolution?
The Green Revolution, right. A time when different seed varieties were developed, and it was primarily focused in Asia. And my brother at the time, back in the 60s, his attempt to stay out of the Vietnam War, he joined the Peace Corps and went as an ag advisor to India and introduced some of those seed varieties. And it was fairly successful. It cut hunger in half at those times, or doubled the food production. It didn't end it certainly, but it doubled some of the crop yields in that part of the world. Another more recent and ongoing effort, and this is one I doubt that you would necessarily come up with, but I'm sure all of you would be familiar with, and that is the United Nations, the UNICEF Child Survival Initiative, where low-cost immunization and especially oral rehydration therapy is saving currently, and for many years in the past since it started, they estimate about 4 million children a year are saved as a result of that program. And we, as a country, contribute, some of our foreign aid goes to this program, along with other countries as well. Another success, you might say, count many countries have received foreign aid, and another success story is another statistic that 25 of the countries that have received foreign aid from us have become self-sustaining and don't receive any more foreign aid from us. So that's another. I'm just trying to give you the good side picture first here, so you don't think it's just all horrible news. But there are some also glaring examples of failure in our foreign aid to help hungry people, and I think one of those failures can be characterized by what was going on during the Cold War era in this country. And why would I call that a failure in terms of foreign aid? What characterized foreign aid during that time that would tend to lead one to describe it as a failure?
More military than anything else.
There was a lot of military aid, that's right, the motive of that foreign aid during that time was not necessarily for development or to help hungry people. The Cold War gives you a picture of what was going on at that time. We were giving money primarily to do what?
To keep Russia out of
communism.
Right, to get countries to come on our side, to be anti-communist. So millions, actually probably billions of dollars went to the Congo at that time to Mobutu. Disappear. I mean, we didn't monitor that money. We didn't track it. We didn't really pay much attention to where it was going. And even today, there's efforts to try to get some of that money back. We can maybe come to that later on. The attitudes of the U.S. public about foreign aid is kind of schizophrenic, at least according to the polls that have been given over the years. There's a bit of more recent poll within the last couple of years that sort of bear that out. 62% in this most recent poll said that the U.S. spends too much on foreign aid. 62%. That's a lot of people. But it actually, if you talk about it, that really reflects the attitude of people. It's actually getting better, because back in 1995, the same poll was given, and 75% of the public thought we spent too much on foreign aid. So fewer people now have that attitude. I think that's kind of interesting, by the way, for people who are doing polls. At the same time that 62% said that we spend too much on foreign aid, 87% said that they favored giving food and medical assistance to people in needy countries. This is the schizophrenic part of it. We think we give too much in foreign aid, but we also, a fairly large majority of the people feel that it's a good thing to do. I'm not sure how to do this very accurately, but I think maybe the best way to do it is just to ask for a response to this question. If I were to give you a quiz now and ask you to estimate what percent of our federal budget goes for foreign aid, some of you, I think, know the answer to this already, but...
Does that include defense?
Yes.
All everything. If you looked at our whole federal budget, everything that's in our, on the expense side, what the federal budget consists of, how much of that federal budget would you say goes for foreign aid? And let's just throw out some figures here, and they may be all over the map, and I can tell you what the poll...
Would foreign aid include arms, shipments to other
countries? Oh yes. Yeah. Foreign aid would be any money that goes to other countries.
So would that be the discrepancy though that some people would think you're talking about weapons when you actually specify food, more people would say they believe.
Right. It's important to be clear when I'm not sure in this poll that was taken if that was clarified for people. I didn't read. I only saw the poll results. I didn't see how that question was asked. But in terms of the percent of the, I'm going to ask the question later on. Will be what percent of our gross national product is spent on development assistance as opposed to foreign aid? Foreign aid now I'm talking about is the big package that goes out that includes humanitarian relief for disasters of any kind. It includes military aid. It includes anything like that. So, if this is the question, then what percent would you say of foreign aid or of the foreign budget what percent of the federal budget would you say goes for foreign aid? We can just sort of throw out figures. Let's just throw out a bunch of figures.
16%.
5%,
4%,
2% is going down. I feel like I'm an auctioneer.
Half a percent.
Anything else? In that poll that was given, the average percent that was given and the answer by to the general public was 20%. That's what they thought it was, 20%. I'll come back to that. And then that was followed with a question, What percent do you think should go to foreign? That was another. I'm not going to ask you that question. But the question was then, what do you think should go? And the answer was about 10% is what they thought we should be willing to send. And of course, the answer in terms of percentage of the federal budget is closest over here. It's just a little more than 0.5%. It's actually about 86 or more. Depends on what year you're looking at it in terms of the budget. I'm using figures now that are about a year old. I don't have the most recent.
Jim, are there any figures on what percentage of that total?
That's all right.
Stephen Miller.
Yeah.
What percentage of that goes to military, and what percentage of it goes to non-military?
Yeah.
Or
okay. I'll come to that. The actual budget itself is about 14. What I've got it down here. 14.9 billion was the foreign ops budget in 2001. So 14.9 billion was the total budget. 4.4 billion goes to programs that deal directly with programs that work with poor and hungry people. So that's the sort of the development side of things, rather than the other part isn't necessarily all military. You can't just assume that the difference that approximately the 10 billion was all military aid. It may have gone to try to develop trade programs or other kinds of things. So it isn't just that. The sad thing about this is that the percentage of foreign aid in this country started dropping drastically about the time of the Cold War in the 60s. If you want to, those of you who have that book, and those of you who don't, you might try to take a look at it, and I'm sorry to refer to this when you don't all have this, but if you go to page 41 in this is the 2001, every year Bread for the World Institute publishes a wonderful report on hunger. This happens to be on foreign aid, but if you turn to page 41, you'll see a chart there that shows the dramatic decline beginning in the 60s. In the 60s, it was up to over 3%. And you can see how it's been dropping steadily and continuing to drop. And another big drop started to occur in the 90s to where it is today. Now, the other interesting thing is there's about 21 countries that are sort of looked at as kind of the what we call the global north, or the industrialized countries, or the wealthy, primarily European countries, but they would include Canada, they would include Australia, and other countries as well. But where does the U.S. Fit compared to these other industrialized countries in terms of foreign aid? If you look at the chart on page 50, you'll see where we fit. Turn to page 50. We're the absolute last. Absolute last. And those of you who have good Scandinavian stock ought to just stand up and cheer, because the first four countries, top four countries, are
Norway,
Denmark, Sweden, and
Finland, or Iceland?
No, Norway. Netherlands.
Netherlands.
Yeah. Netherlands, mm-hmm. Norway. That's, I think, you know, interesting. Now, the other thing, a lot of this stuff you may already know too, but in terms of the countries to which the aid goes, or how the aid flows, what countries would you guess receive most of our foreign aid, if you were to list those countries from most in terms of dollars? No.
Israel and Egypt.
Israel
and Egypt.
Clear at the top. At the top.
What about Colombia?
And this, as of 2 years ago, Colombia jumped into third place, a country that wasn't even on the chart before that, when
If any of you are around next week, you can come to my session on Columbia, and you'll find out why we are pouring billions of dollars into that country. You know? What's interesting about Israel and Egypt, of course, is that they're not poor countries. Now, Egypt is considered a middle-income country. I think turn to page... here it is, 48. There's a little box on top of 48 that says, Egypt has a per capita income of $1,400, which puts it in the middle income category. Israel is estimated to have a per capita income of $9,266, qualifying it as a high income country. And together, they represent over 20% of all foreign aid. Just those two countries represent 20% of our foreign aid. Another interesting way of looking at, and I'm going to... that isn't the right one. You can take that one, but it won't do you any good.
Okay, that's
right. I've run out. I'm sorry.
Oh, you're out.
You just have... These are other ones that I'm giving away now that... You can, all this stuff is all giveaways. I'm sorry about that. I had one whole suitcase that was full of some of these, but I came. But if we were to look at the amount of money that is given just for what we call official development assistance now, which would be the smaller amount within the foreign aid, and we would figure out what that would represent in terms of per capita contributions from the U.S. Every one of you in this room, basically, somewhere out of your tax dollars, you contributed about $29 a year to what we would define as foreign aid that goes for poverty work, increasing development assistance. I'm not talking about military aid, though. I'm just talking about what we
consider
humanitarian aid, the good kind of aid that we think of. It's not always well spent or well used, but it's in that kind of category, at least with that intention. Looking at the same list of 21 countries, the median figure for all of those 21 countries is $70. A year. So we're far, far below the median at $29 per year. The country with the highest per capita giving, Denmark, $316 per capita per year. There's only one country that's lower than the U.S. in terms of per capita giving in that list of 21 countries. And it's probably one of the poorest of the 21 countries, and that's Portugal. A few dollars less than the United States. Otherwise, every country is way above us. So that sort of gives you an idea of where we are currently. And it's not where I think the general perception is that we are, because I think some people think we're just really out there leading the way. Anyway. Yes?
On page 51... There's a bar chart that shows Portugal leading in aid from DAC members to least developed countries. So it seems like Portugal is particularly good at aiming its aid to needy countries.
Right. That's what that yes. In other words, they're not giving a whole lot of military aid. Right. Right. Even though they don't have much to give in terms of total dollars.
But
as a percentage. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Well, I don't want to make too much of the statistics, but these I think are important for us to understand because it gives us a kind of picture of where we are in this framework. Well, how are these foreign aid dollars dispersed? For those of you who you've got the books and can take them home, you can maybe make a note to turn. You know, I don't necessarily want you to do that now, but there's a chart on page 42 which gives the whole breakdown of the budget so you can see where things go. But basically, there's sort of two major categories. It's what we term bilateral aid, and bilateral aid is dollars from this country to another country. In other words, it goes directly from the U.S. in a loan or a grant. These are dollars that just flow to another country without going through any other intermediary. Well, they may be dispersed through like USAID. And we'll come to that in a little bit. And then there's multilateral aid where we would be giving money to the United Nations Development Program or the World Bank for some of their projects. It would come through another multilateral agency of some kind. With USAID, I think what people are surprised to learn is that a growing percentage over the years in USAID, a growing percentage of their money is flowing through what we call PVOs, private voluntary organizations, one of which is Global Relief. Okay, they give their money to other agencies. In fact, about 10% of Lutheran World Relief has a budget that's not quite 30, about 28 million, about 28 million a year. And about 10% of that is in the federal contract, primarily in the area of relief, emergency relief. About 100,000 of that is for ocean freight to ship those quilts and medical supplies over the countries where they need them. So that's important to know. But I think it would be interesting for you to see. Let's see if I've got that listed down here. Turn to page 9. At the bottom of page 9. Is a chart of just a few selected. Lutheran World Relief isn't listed there, that's why I gave you those figures. But these are private voluntary organizations such as CARE, Catholic Relief Services, World Vision, some of the big, what we call the biggies, the large ones. It shows what their total budget is, and then it shows what percent of their funds come from the U.S. government. There's quite a difference. Catholic Relief Services has a budget of about $233 million. I mean, they're the biggies on the block. We are at $30 million, very small. But what that represents, about over half of their money, over half of their budget comes from federal dollars. 52%. It's interesting that World Vision, if some of you are familiar with World Vision, they're even bigger than Catholic Relief Services. $358 billion a year. But they only get 15% of that from the federal government. So it's kind of interesting. I think these are things that people who support these organizations aren't aware of.
What was it? Lutheran World Relief percentage again? 10%?
Yes, about 10%.
Yeah. Right,
about 10%. We really aren't anxious to increase that because we get real nervous about because there are strings that go with those federal dollars sometimes that make it difficult for us to operate. And it's the dynamics of it are interesting. The Catholics have a strong lobby in Washington, D.C. to get those funds. And I can tell you a lot of stories about that. So, now, let's... The Millennium Challenge goals are a set of 8 very specific, they're time-bound, in other words, there's a time frame to them, goals that have been developed primarily out of the United Nations, where about 100 and close to 190 countries, U.S. included, back in 2000, there was a Millennium Summit meeting that took place in which they set these goals, and they were goals that they wanted to have completed by the year 2015. And the baseline for those goals, because they were numerical goals, goals. The baseline was the figures that were in place in the year 1990. So here the goals were set in the year 2000, and the goals were based on in terms of what they wanted to achieve in the year 2015. For example, a goal which was to cut the first goal was to cut poverty and hunger in half, reduce by half the proportion of people who suffer from hunger. So they used the figures here, the number of people in 1990 that suffered from hunger, and they wanted to cut these figures in half by the year 2000. So all of these numerical goals that they have are based on that. This is a chart from the United Nations Development Program, and I'll just read the brief goals. I've read the first one, eradicate extreme poverty and hunger, and they use the figure by half the proportion of people who suffer from hunger. Second one, achieve universal primary education. Well, that's a pretty big goal. It's limited in the sense we're talking about primary education, 1 through, I think it's 6 rather than 8. But that's for all boys and girls, complete a full course of primary school, second goal. Third one, promote gender equality and empower women. And that is eliminate the gender disparity in primary and secondary education, preferably by 2005, which isn't very far off, and at all levels by 2015. The fourth goal, reduce child mortality by 2/3, reduce the mortality rate among children under 5, improve maternal health, and this was reduced by 3/4, the maternal mortality ratio. Sixth, combat HIV/AIDS, malaria, and other diseases, and they wanted to reduce, cut the incidence by half, reverse the by half the incidence of malaria and other major diseases. The seventh one, ensure environmental sustainability, and that has to do with, well, the goal related to safe drinking water, reduced by half the proportion of people without sustainable access to safe drinking water. And then the eighth, develop a global partnership for development, and that gets into a whole list of things that I won't take the time to read. Now, let's talk about successes, and I want to get back to those successes. More specifically in relationship to these goals. What I'd like to do is share with you some of the progress that has been made in terms of world poverty, so that you have some sense of sort of historical perspective here. With the help of foreign assistance, adult illiteracy in developing countries fell 47% in 1970, which was from 1970, the incidence of adult illiteracy in developing countries fell from 47% in 1970 to 20% in 1990. That's a big drop. Smallpox was eliminated from the world in 1977. Since 1960, life expectancy in poor countries has risen from 45 to 64. Now we're starting to see a reverse of that, primarily because of the impact of HIV/AIDS. But at least until that came on the scene, there was that's an incredible growth from 45 to 64.
And what years are these from 70?
Since 1960. In 1960, life expectancy in poor countries now, not just an average of the whole, just in what was identified as poor countries, rose from 45 to 64.
In what year? What started our final year then? There, 98 or 99?
In about 90, even 97, 98 is when the numbers started to go down in some countries. But because it's just been in a few countries, it still is hanging up there pretty high. From 1960 to 2001, The number of people living below the poverty line fell by 200 million. And this was even when the world population grew by 1.6 billion. So it's pretty dramatic. It's not only, I mean, it's keeping up and then also lowering the poverty line by 200 million. Due to expanded access to education and increased food availability, malnutrition in children has declined from 46.5% in 1970 to 27% in the year 2000. With better access to health care, education, and family planning, maternal deaths were reduced by 12% between 1990 and 95. So in 5 years, maternal deaths, that's deaths in childbirth, was reduced by 12%. And this last one is, I think, very debatable because I'm not sure how they define this, but today there are 121 democratically elected governments in the world. I'm not sure what that always means. But that's 55 more than 15 years ago. So that's sort of, I mean, there are some good things that have happened. Also, in terms of these millennium, looking at these goals that we have now relating to education and child mortality, there have been some significant successes in specific countries. There have been improvements in education in countries like Guinea, Malawi, and Uganda. There have been significant improvements in the incidence of HIV/AIDS in countries like Senegal, Thailand, and Uganda again. Improvements in child mortality rates in Bangladesh and Gambia. In nutrition in Mexico, Indonesia, and Tunisia. And the level of poverty level has risen dramatically also in China. Polio cases globally dropped from nearly in 1990, there was about 250,000 cases of polio. In the year 2000, it was less than 3,000 cases, from 250,000 to 3,000. So there have been some significant changes there. But there have also been some setbacks in specific countries. Mortality rates under 5 increased in countries like Cambodia, Kenya, Malawi, and Zambia. And part of these are due to HIV/AIDS. Gender gap in primary education grew in Eritrea, Ethiopia, and Namibia. Malnutrition increased in Burkina Faso and Yemen. Access to water in general had become much more difficult. We've already heard that story. It's so ironic that last night, you know, I just heard this. I mean, we talked about the God of abundance, you know, and we think of water as being so abundant, but safe drinking water is becoming so scarce around the world. And, of course, the HIV prevalence rate in countries, some countries has doubled, tripled, quadrupled, and in some countries increased 10 times. If you come, if you're still here next week and come to the HIV/AIDS workshop that we're doing, you'll find out that the military, well, let me start with this statistic. Poor women who come for prenatal care in Zimbabwe, the incidence of HIV, when they, because that's part of the testing that they receive, is 40%. 40% of the women who come for prenatal care now. If you took a test of the military, the army, in that country, you'll find out that 95% of them are HIV positive. So these are sort of just incredible statistics. It's just hard to imagine. And it's devastating for Africa, and Africa is the general feeling is that they're sort of at the peak overall, and hopefully that will start to go down. But countries that are not even nearing the peak are sort of coming into where Africa was maybe 5 or 10 years ago. Our countries in Asia, India especially, and China, and Eastern European countries. So, anyway, those are, that's kind of the picture of foreign aid, and just one sort of footnote, and then we can have some discussion, and that is Saturday's, I came out here last Saturday and picked up the New York Times, and move them off to the side here, and found this interesting article about, do aid studies govern policies or reflect them? It's a very long article, but what it does is it talks about, well, let me step back and say, one of the responses to this, to these Millennium Development Goals, when President Bush went down to Monterrey, Mexico last year, he announced this major $15 billion aid package in 5 years, and it was called the Millennium Challenge Account, and it was to double. The goal was to double the foreign aid program. But the catch was this, that it would only go to countries, this is the difficulty. The good news was that a lot more money was made available. But the bad news, from my point of view, and from others who work, and also sort of affirmed in this article, was that only those countries who were sort of meeting all of the requirements, they had transparency, and they had they were fulfilling some of the conditionalities that the international financial institutions were making, and they had growth rates that were positive. Those were the countries that were going to get it. And if you took those qualifications or standards, only about 5 African countries would qualify. So the question that we have, those of us who are involved in advocacy work for what I call the church or church-related institutions, ask the question, well, what happens to the poor people in these other countries? How do we deal with them? And it's interesting that in this article, I won't take the time to go into the details, but what they were saying is that these policies, these sort of requirements for countries, for the policies that were going to be used to determine what countries receive the funds, these policies were developed primarily in the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund by theoretical economists that use models of economic theory to determine what countries are going to get the money and what countries have been most successful. And what a new study by the same people, not the same people, by economists in the same organization have just recently come out and say the reality, it just ain't so. And so there's difference of opinion even within the World Bank, and we've been sort of saying that for a long time. I've been the person who's, I won't get involved in the personalities because that's, I never did like the guy who, his name was Dollar. Can you believe that? An economist whose name is Dollar. And he was the one who was promoting these standards of how you determine growth. And they just didn't take into account some of the categories that I thought were important. Well, I want to shut up and be quiet because I'm sure you have some questions and we can have some discussion about this. So let me just be quiet.
This is sort of a side question, but of those countries like Egypt and Israel, who are really wealthy countries that we give foreign aid to, do they in turn claim that they give foreign aid to someone, or are they?
Well,
does it stop there?
I don't know. I'm not familiar with Egypt, but I know that Israel has is involved with some. You know, they have projects in Africa. I know they had people in Liberia, but it may have been, you know, I was in Liberia in the late 60s and early 70s, and I know they had technicians that would go in and give advice. They certainly didn't have Peace Corps volunteers, but I mean, they But it was. It's more in the area of trying to win, sort of like what we were doing.
Yeah.
Involved. It involves sort of geopolitical goals.
It's sort of like adopt how it's going to be given, thinking we know what our interests are,
right.
And they can turn around and take that very same money and use it to develop what they think their interests are. Then.
Right. One of my concerns, and I suppose this is getting beyond what I'm talking about here. But I sort of have a passion for Liberia because I lived there 3 years. And, you know, when you live in a place like that, and I mean, people get in your heart and the country sort of gets under your skin. And it seemed to me so inconsistent with, you know, we had this policy or justification for going into Iraq. And given those same... Granted, Liberia didn't have weapons of mass destruction. I mean, it's a joke what they did. Well, it isn't a joke. I mean, they did use diamond money and timber money to buy, you know, weapons. But in terms of weapons of mass destruction, they didn't have that. But they obviously there's evidence now, it hasn't been public, made too public, but the sale of the terrorist cell, well, who was the first guy? The Al-Qaeda folks were involved to protect some of their investments, were buying diamonds from Taylor in Liberia. So here you have a situation where this guy is causing all these problems, but because it's not considered supposedly in our strategic interest, we aren't going to involve ourselves there, even when it would take just a, you know, a small amount of troops. Anyway, I won't get into that. But I mean, what is in our strategic interest? It's interesting that the director of USAID, in a speech that he gave that I heard in Washington D.C. recently, really criticized all these, you know, I said that 40% of their funds go to NGOs. And he came into a meeting of these NGOs, our group being one of them, I mean, the whole group in front of him, and he said, I'm sick and tired of these NGOs not giving the U.S. credit for the money they're getting and the work that they're doing. And he says, I'm going to start just tearing up contracts if I feel that you aren't giving the U.S. credit. Well, it's very difficult for us to, especially if we're in humanitarian relief situations, and especially after a situation of war, it's very difficult for us to be associated with one government or another. That's one reason why we don't like to use government money and come in. But here he was saying that the NGOs are a tool of U.S. foreign policy. We really get nervous when we hear that from heads of organizations. That maybe didn't answer your question. Other comments? Or
I'm curious because I just don't know enough about this, but you know, sort of talk a little about the way the United States operates its foreign aid situation. And of course, then you look at where we are in terms of you know, our percentage, and we're woefully low. Now, what about other countries, Canada, European countries, the Scandinavian nations that we mentioned, that are so high in terms of, on the top of the list, in terms of the percentage of what they contribute? Is much of their policy also involved with military aid, with strategic aid, and that sort of thing, or is it of more appropriate on humanitarian?
I'm not knowledgeable there. Let me give an example. Colombia. A number of years ago, there was this plan. It was Plan Colombia originally, and the plan was to combine the effort to fight what they call the war on drugs, and also the kind of counterinsurgency effort, which primarily turned out to be a military package. The European community was supposed to do the social development, the development work, and the non-military kind of thing. When the U.S. came in with primarily a military package, the European community basically pulled out, and they said, we can't operate under those conditions because we don't think we're going to be successful. That's an example where to be involved in military. But obviously, I'm sure Sweden, I think Sweden makes military jets, don't they? I mean, and they compete with other people in the world to sell military equipment. But U.S. is primarily the supplier of armaments throughout the world.
U.K.
is so
big.
What?
U.K. is big.
And U.K. is big too. And
Israel is also.
There are some Eastern European countries that are also more under illegally or more undercover doing some of that. Yeah. What did you say?
I was just saying one issue, and again, I don't have numbers behind this, but I find so objectionable in the way the U.S. operates its aid is that in a lot of ways it's a backdoor handout to our defense industry, simply to give the money that comes back around and pays for the military aid. I mean, if it's not direct, if we aren't handing somebody a jet, we're handing them the ability to go and buy the jet from. Either way, it's basically a subsidy, if you look at it that way.
Some of the development aid projects, some of the restrictions that Congress puts on those funds is that they have to go to U.S. companies. I mean, it's understandable. I mean, we want employment here. But Lutheran World Relief, for example, is non-operational. In other words, we don't have our folks overseas. We give our money to local people who know the situation, who do that work in that setting, and we figure it's a wiser use of that money. But because of these other, so we would never be able to get some of the money that USAID does make available. So there are strings attached to that, and it makes it difficult. Back here.
I have a couple questions about the statistics.
Yeah.
And you might not be able to answer this, but one was whether federal budgets for each of these countries were sort of lined up apples to apples. I'm familiar in some of my work that, say, the Netherlands money that I was working under was not considered part of their federal budget and yet was still aid from the Netherlands. There's a difference country to country concerning on-budget and off-budget items that might affect the rankings. And let me play this out a little bit further.
Yeah, go ahead.
Another question about the statistics would be whether other countries also have substantial private efforts, as we do in this country, and whether if you added federal efforts to private efforts, whether the rankings would change for the country. Because some of those countries don't have substantial private efforts, some of the countries on your list. And the U.S. does have relatively large private efforts compared to some countries. So that might affect the statistics a little bit there. But finally, I'm interested really in the difference from your perspective in humanitarian relief against, say, development-related federal aid. How much money is going to each, and what works?
So the difference between, say that again, between
humanitarian relief
and humanitarian relief.
Yes.
Okay. Go back to the first question.
So first, I'm wondering.
Let me just respond to that. The figures that Bread for the World Institute uses, and the figures that I was using in my presentation, were figures primarily that come out of the United Nations. It's not the U.S., so that the extent to which the reporting is accurate and comparing apples with apples and oranges with oranges, which is what you're saying, I couldn't answer that. But I know each country is unique in the way it, for example, Norway, Norway basically collects, taxes from its citizens and gives it back to the Norwegian Church Aid. Norwegian Church Aid doesn't get so much money directly from its people. It's routed through the government. It goes to the government, then it comes back to Norwegian Church Aid, Danish Church Aid, and it's almost like a tax. So it would be almost, probably a very high percentage of their money would be considered, even though they're a church-related organization, would be considered government aid.
So when in fact, it might be considered private in that
case. Yes, right. It might be considered. But in terms of the government statistics, they would register all of it as
yes,
federal.
Right. And the reason I was pursuing that line of questioning was, if we're going to make a case for increased aid, where do we make the case? Are we asking for, are we saying we are ranked very low, we should be ranked higher? Are we saying that explicitly, that we would like to have a large percentage of the federal budget going to federal aid, and if so, what kind?
Let me talk about the UN development goals that sort of most of the member nations have sort of agreed to as a goal. They would like to see the contribution from what we consider the wealthy countries to be 0.7% of gross national product of GNP, using those figures rather than federal budget figures.
Mm-hmm. What's our GNP?
What is our percent of GNP?
No, what is our GNP?
And I don't know. I mean, I don't know what that amount is. I know what our aid is in relationship to GNP, and it's 0.1%.
So then we raise it up by a factor of 7.
Right. That's what we do. Now, there are very few countries that have achieved 0.7.
Right.
Very few countries are at that level. The Scandinavian countries are higher, but I don't know if there are very many countries that are even. I think there may be one or two countries that are at 1%, but that's I couldn't tell you that for sure either. So that gets into another kind of calculation about what should be done. So, but I think that all of these. I want to keep. The next question was the humanitarian aid or relief aid in response to emergencies as compared to development aid, right?
Because they seem very different to me in terms of
yeah.
what is being done and what is expected.
I'm trying to think. There's several kinds of humanitarian. I'm watching the time here. I'm not trying to duck your question, so if I don't answer it, we'll do it afterwards. I want to honor the time. We have about another minute, right? Or are we even past that?
Page 47 has a pie chart that might be helpful.
Page 47. Does it show a breakdown of that? Does it answer his question?
Well, not. It may be helpful. I'm not sure that
I don't see that.
Directly.
Oh, there it says. Oh, yeah. Major. It says emergency aid. At 11.2%. That was in 97 to 98. But emergency aid, the figures are going to be so skewed now because of what's happened in Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, there's just a lot of that is considered emergency aid. And there are a lot of differences between the aid. Emergency aid as it relates to what we call a natural disaster, meaning a tornado or an earthquake or a flood, as opposed to the emergency aid that takes place in the aftermath of a conflict of some kind. That's a lot different. And I know that in the world, let me just talk about it in terms of Lutheran world belief. We were heavily involved in Hurricane Mitch, response to Hurricane Mitch in Nicaragua and Central America when that happened. I don't know how many years ago that is now, but most of the people came in, did their people were without homes, people were hungry, and so U.S. government aid, Lutheran World Relief, a lot of people were there on the ground responding. We're still there. We're not doing what we call humanitarian relief, but one of our criticisms of humanitarian relief is that it doesn't have built into it what we call development aid component, so that it's just there to sort of bind up the, take care of the most immediate problems, but it doesn't do preventative work for the next time around, because even though you probably can't ensure that your home will be protected from the next hurricane, there are certain places where people were building homes that even minus a hurricane, we're fragile. So what we're doing is working with building codes, with building standards, with the kind of, you know, where people are building their homes and what kind of quality of construction goes into that, so that there's some built-in. So how do you distinguish between, I mean, we're still sort of calling it a response to Hurricane Mitch, but it's really now development kind of work.
And that's interesting information, because I think it starts to tell us, if you're going to consider foreign aid as an issue that you mm-hmm. want to know more about, what are some characteristics you might look for? Yeah. And that sounds like a very good example of looking at an organization that does humanitarian emergency relief. Does it also include some sort of development component, or does it not? If you're trying to think of, is money being wasted, used well, where do we push, what do we ask?
Let me just do one more final thing, and then I have to close this down. And that is in the development work that we're doing, our focus is beginning to be more and more on strengthening the capacity of people in local communities, very poor and impoverished people, and I can give you wonderful stories in India and other places, so that it isn't a situation where we're constantly trying to pour money in to respond to people who are poor and hungry, so that we develop their capacity to develop sort of democratic, to hold their officials accountable to whatever extent they can in the communities where they're living. Many people are just used to, and this is a criticism of foreign aid, you develop dependency relationships if you're continually going in, providing assistance in this year after year after year. And it's easy to do because people continue to be hungry year after year. But unless you're developing the strength of that community to grow its own food and to hold its own government officials, even at the very local level, accountable for the money that they spend and their access to the decisions that are being made that affect them, I think that's a whole other area of development work that most people don't think about, because most people think about just transferring resources, money, materials from country A to country B. And I haven't even opened up that window to us. I probably should have talked more about that. But I want you to know that it's going on, and it's something that some of the better relief organizations and development organizations are doing. Thank you for coming. I'm sorry to go over your time here.